This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Alex Forsyth. Thank you for downloading the podcast for this edition of the Westminster Hour for the 30th of July. This week we've had the Chancellor's vision of the path to Brexit, but do all of his Cabinet colleagues agree? There are questions too for Labour about whether they're clear on what the UK's future relationship with the EU should look like. We'll hear from my panel of MPs and journalists about that. We'll also hear from the architect of tuition fees about why he thinks the system's now unsustainable. And do faith and politics really mix? On my panel tonight, Emily Thornberry, Nadeem Zahawi and Matt Kelly. Emily Thornberry is the Shadow Foreign Secretary and also the Shadow First Secretary of State. She recently stood in for Jeremy Corbyn at Prime Minister's Questions, going head-to-head with Damian Green across the dispatch box. And you look like you quite enjoyed that, Emily. Was it fun?
It was fun after a bit. To begin with, it was a bit nervous, but yeah, and when I relaxed into it, it was fun.
Dare I ask a possible deputy party leader?
No. This stuff kind of bubbles up when the media haven't got anything else to write. And if you want to get onto the front page of the Times, clearly what you have to do is you have to say, I have absolutely nothing to say about that. And then it becomes a story. So, yeah, honestly.
We'll find plenty to talk about tonight. Nadeem Zahawi, welcome. The Conservative MP for Stratford-upon-Avon. You began life in Baghdad, fleeing to this country at the age of 9 with his Iraqi Kurdish parents. And before entering Parliament, he founded the leading market research and polling company, YouGov. So with that background in polling, I presume you predicted your party would lose its majority at the election.
Well, YouGov and Sam Coates's Times newspaper had that front page headline, which clearly sent shockwaves through Westminster, both to the Labour Party. I remember some Labour colleagues saying that they thought in their associations, or at least the momentum part of their association, that this was some bit of black art by Zahawi to prevent Labour voters from turning out. And of course, as I'm sure Sam and his colleagues would testify, you know, as a pollster, you've got to just deliver the numbers. And what YouGov did was this, I think, an interesting piece of innovation as a model that predicted the, sadly, the hung parliament. So I was a bit torn because I saw a tweet from Jim Messina saying, you know, another rubbish piece of work from YouGov, in that he would delight at laughing at them after the election. I wanted them desperately to be wrong, by the way.
Yeah, so as a pollster, you were pleased. As a politician for the Conservative
Someone
Party,
who founded the business, I was clearly proud of them, what they did as a piece of work, but clearly very upset that that was the outcome. But there we go.
There we go, indeed. And our third panellist tonight, Matt Kelly, the editor of The New European, the newspaper which styles itself for the 48%, i.e. those who voted Remain in the referendum. It's just celebrated its first year of publication. So launching a pro-Remain newspaper in the age of social media, when the country's just back Brexit, are you just brave?
Brave or crazy, but it's worked anyway. I mean, we launched it 9 days after the referendum, and we had the intention of running it for just 4 weeks. We called it pop-up publishing, and we anticipated a sort of glorious exit very quickly, but people seem to latch onto it, and our readership and our subscription base grows and grows. We out every Thursday. We just transformed to a tabloid format from a Berliner format, and circulation is going up every week, and it goes up as the agenda keeps shifting and the heat keeps rising on Brexit, you know. So I'm in the invidious position of feeling like the only guy in Britain who's done well out of Brexit so far. So,
well, we haven't had Brexit yet, so
no,
that
quite,
remains to
quite,
be seen.
Yes, exactly.
But also with us is Sam Coates, the deputy political editor of The Times, and I'm hoping you'll give us all the stories behind the stories. The first of which is the fact the cabinet is said to be coalescing around the idea of a post-Brexit transition period to smooth our departure from the EU, allowing time for the government and for business to prepare for new rules on immigration and trade. The Chancellor, Philip Hammond, said last week that interim period could last up until the next general election, which of course is due in 2022. And it could mean, according to Philip Hammond, the day after Brexit, not much changes. He said EU nationals would still be able to come to the UK if they registered. Today, according to the Sunday Times, the International Trade Secretary, Liam Fox, said if free movement continued after 2019, it would not keep faith with the referendum result. So, Sam, help us unpick this, because it seems that we have some broad agreement within the cabinet on the principle of a transition deal, but still some sticking points around the detail. Talk us through what they are.
Yes, well, it feels like in the last 6 days, we've had pretty much more detail than we've had in much of the last 6 months about what most of the cabinet want to happen next on Brexit. It was outlined last week, mostly by Philip Hammond, the Chancellor, and Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary, notably in a week where Theresa May was in Northern Italy having some time off. So while she was out of the country, they were able to expand a bit on what's likely to happen. And as you say, what we got was the outline of what they hope is a deal, a transition period of 1 to 3 years, that transition period starting off being more or less what we've got at the moment, and then that changes over the time, the trade agreements staying roughly what they are at the start. And I think all of those things are agreed, and then you would be out of it by the time of the next election. I think all of those points have agreement across the cabinet. But then on Thursday in the Financial Times, Amber Rudd, and on Friday on Radio 4 on the Today programme, Philip Hammond, both said a little bit more. They both said that, broadly speaking, immediately after Brexit, you're going to get the migration system the same as it was immediately before Brexit. Now, this appears to have caused some problems. There's cross-cabinet agreement that we should start registering people who come into the country after March 2019.
After the Brexit date.
After the Brexit date, after the 2 years of Brexit in March 2019. But there is not, we understand, cross-cabinet agreement to go further than that, to either keep the situation the same or to start immediately limiting the numbers of people coming in. And this has been the subject of quite a big row at the cabinet level in the last 2 or 3 days. Now, you've got to understand that not only has Theresa May been absent on holiday, but you've got quite a few members of the cabinet who've actually been overseas. Michael Fallon and Boris Johnson, both in Australia, Liam Fox in America. And when people are away from their kind of away from their terminals and far away from Whitehall, all of these statements seem to be even more prone to increasing their blood pressure. And in particular, Liam Fox and Boris Johnson have been unimpressed. Unimpressed not just with what's been said, but also how it's been seen to be said. And they are making clear this evening that neither of them specifically back the idea that migration won't go down straight after Brexit.
And we've had a bit of a development this evening involving the Foreign Secretary. Just briefly take us through that.
Well, you know that tensions are quite high when somebody like the Foreign Secretary has to deny a claim that he was about to resign today. Now, this all stems from Vince Cable, the Liberal Democrat leader, who put out a press release earlier today saying that he'd heard rumours, I believe, from a senior civil servant. Who knows? Was it true? We don't know. But it is quite something when formally the Foreign Secretary has to deny that he's resigning over something like this. It does suggest that something is not quite right in Great King's, in King Charles Street, and we wait to see quite how it unpicks and whether or not this guy, who is ultimately meant to be liberal on migration, backs the Chancellor in his more liberal plan, or Liam Fox, who perhaps believes that migration should be curbed more urgently.
Sam, thank you. Nadeem Sarwi, it seems like we've got two things going on here. We have got this notion of a transitional deal. And firstly, as someone who campaigned for Brexit, I'd be interested in what you think about that. But also, there seems to be still, despite this echo of unanimity, divisions at the very senior level about this. What do you make of it all?
Well, I suspect a lot of the headlines are because, you know, Sam and his colleagues, you know, thrive on these headlines. That's their trade. And I suspect actually the cabinet is much closer to the view that we need an implementation period. So once we've got through the negotiation, March 19th, we essentially control our borders, as the immigration minister said the day before Philip Hammond went on Radio 4. Brandon Lewis and the Home Secretary said pretty much the same thing.
And there actually, seemed to be when
Philip Hammond was asked directly, does he agree with Brandon Lewis that we will control our borders on, you know, the next day, March 2019, he said yes, absolutely. I guess the nuance here is you're going to need an implementation period, which was in Amber Rudd's letter, and I think that this is what, you know, you're sort of trying to pick differences between people.
There seems to be a bit of difference about whether we're talking about free movement or control of borders.
But control of borders means control of borders. So you register, you know, Europeans who want to come to the UK, but you want to make that registration process as easy as possible, so that you don't have a cliff edge for the economy, for business, and so on. I don't think I voted for Brexit. Many of my colleagues, Anne-Marie Trevelyan, who's very much a Brexiteer, tweeted out as soon as Philip Hammond finished his interview, I think, that this is the right approach to this. So I think we just need to take a deep breath and just think, well, is this sort of silly season? And we're getting into this situation where columns have to be written. There's not much going on. So let's write about, well, the difference is, is Boris going to resign tonight? I mean, clearly we're into silly season when you get that sort of thing happening. But and the source of it being Vince Cable.
Would you be happy for free movement to continue for a period of up to 3 years after the March 19 date of departure?
There's going to need to be a period of implementation, clearly, because, just think it through. The Home Office has to then implement a process, whether it's technology or human beings, who we will have to make sure when Europeans are coming across, they can come across but are registered. And that process has to be as easy as we can make it possibly. So if there's going to be an implementation period, you've got to get that right. And what Philip Hammond then said is, look, it shouldn't go on beyond the general election of 2022. And that should be the sort of the timeline we should look at. But as I said, all this stuff is going to be raked over. One of the difficulties in this process is every bit of negotiation, or even before the Brexit secretary has actually done any negotiation. Actually, Philip Hammond did say that David Davis will be negotiating this stuff. Then the speculation is rife, and you've got to just live with that.
Yeah, Emily, Labour has broadly welcomed what the Chancellor was saying about the need for a transition period, but there's still a bit of a lack of clarity about what should come at the end of that period from Labour's perspective, particularly when it comes to whether the UK should stay in the single market.
I think it's more than welcoming Philip Hammond talking about a transition period. I think anybody who spends more than an hour or so looking at this issue realises that there is absolutely no way that Britain could have an agreement with the European Union that would work into the future with our relationship with Europe and organise all of that within 2 years. And then if they looked at the reality, which is that in the last year, as far as I can see, the government has done nothing. I mean, seriously, done nothing apart from try and argue amongst themselves, position amongst themselves as to what the right approach will be. I mean, they will come back and they will say, oh, look at the white paper, look at Theresa May's speech. Theresa May's speech had every single promise, every aspiration that anybody's ever wanted in relation to Europe, and hoovered it all up and stuck it in a speech and said, there you are, we're going to deliver all of that. You can't. And so our position has always been that, and it has been the one that any responsible government has had over the centuries, any government throughout the world has always wanted to put the safety and security of its citizens first and the economy second. And those have been our guiding lights throughout. And if you're going to put the safety and security of the citizens first and the economy second, of course you can't cut, even if you were to go into it responsibly and with a united approach right from a year ago today and had gone into those negotiations properly and started looking at it so that you had a clear idea, nevertheless, you wouldn't be able to organise it in 2 years. But what have they been doing? They've been frittering, they've been messing about, fighting amongst themselves, deciding they're going to have an election, deciding they're going to do this, people go off on holiday. I mean, it would be funny if it wasn't so profoundly tragic for our country.
So it seems to be that there is the buzzword of pragmatism approaching these negotiations now, whereby there is a time limit. It might not be done within that period. There has to be implementation. So, Emily, would Labour support the idea that free movement continues for 2-3 years post-March 2019?
It has been our understanding that within that two-year period, we would essentially be negotiating the divorce. It would be the leaving the European Union. But the continuing relationship with the European Union, first of all, is something that would need to be negotiated over a much longer period. And indeed, isn't something that will be one agreement and then it will be fixed. It will be an ongoing negotiation with the European Union as we continue to have our relationship with them. And so one has to be able to, when going into a negotiation, go with broad principles in mind, but not go sweeping things off the table.
Matt, of course, the bit that we're not talking about here is that it isn't just about the UK deciding its position then presenting it to Brussels. There are 27 other countries involved, and this will all be subject to negotiation. Do you think that there is just a sense of optimism on behalf of the government? They continue the negotiation for as long as they want, and at the end of it, they still get the deal they desire.
Well, I mean, if that's the case, I think they're madder than it seems, and it seems pretty mad. Just to pick up the point about the silly season, I've been in journalism 30 years. I can't remember a less silly season than this one. I mean, it's absolutely jam-packed, or ram-packed, as Jeremy says, with news, and it's not silly. You know, it's very, very serious, this. And all of these clarifying statements that the Tories are having to make suggests that there is a problem there. You know, if there wasn't a problem, they wouldn't have to be out on the doorstep every minute clarifying stuff. You're absolutely right. It's almost a sense of arrogance, I think, in the way this is being positioned, that here we are, this is what we've decided, this is how things will play out. Meanwhile, Michel Barnier and the 27 are sitting back and just literally sitting back and letting this unfold, and with a great deal of bemusement, I think. They were expecting arrogance from Britain. I don't think they were expecting absolute Keystone coppery. I mean, it's been bizarrely shameful to watch your performance out on the European stage play out. And I think a lot of people in the UK are looking at ourselves and thinking, gosh, is this what we've become? You know, is this the truth? Is this where we're at? Because, you know, we look like absolute fools out there on the European
stage. Nadeem, do you want to come back on that?
I do want to come back on that, on both Emily's point and Matt's point. I think you're doing an injustice to the 98 very talented human beings who are now actually in Brussels, who are been doing all the hard work, the heavy lifting.
I'm not criticising the civil servants.
Let me just finish.
If you don't give them any political leadership, what on earth are they supposed to do?
Emily, I didn't cut across you, okay. So allow me to finish. Okay. It's late at night, so let's keep this civil. What I'm saying is you both delivered a narrative that this whole thing hasn't been thought through. Actually, that's not true. You know, if you talk to the civil servants who are now involved in this process, there's lots of effort being put into this negotiation, which is why we're getting to, as Sam mentioned, we're getting now some more clarity on the positioning vis-a-vis European citizens and what the implementation period will look like. These are important things. So let's not belittle our team and the process. Let's not sit around here and say they're all fools, they're all idiots, and this is going to be a disaster.
Just briefly, Matt.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a bit of straw man stuff going on there. I don't think anyone's belittling the civil service at all. What I am
called the Keystone Coppery.
Yeah, no, what I am belittling is our leading politicians' performance on the European stage and the fact that after a year of this, we seem completely ill-equipped to
it would
to
be
know
nice
what
of you to open
taking.
By saying there's some very good people who've been doing a lot of work for the past year.
I think it's
now, this is a political programme, and we're talking about the politicians, right? Yeah. And the civil servants' jobs is to take their lead from politicians. And if you guys have no idea what it is that you're doing, you really, nobody is blaming the civil servants. Can I just put my hand on my heart, make that perfectly clear? You know, and frankly, the Foreign Office is an absolute brains trust for Britain, and we are not using it sufficiently well.
Emily, I'd just be interested to know if Labour is clear about what it's doing when it comes to Brexit, because we seem to have this huge difference of opinion about the single market. And today we've had Lord Kinnock and Lord Falconer suggesting that that should stay on the table. What is Labour's position on the single market?
So our position is that we need to be able to negotiate a new relationship with the European Union. And we're not sweeping any options off the table. We do it within the parameters that I've set out, you know, what it is that our principles are. And you know, and some of the people who've been making a contribution to the debate, you know, their contribution is greatly welcome. But, you know, with respect to them, they're not the ones who are leading the party on this.
But it should stay on the table, the single market.
What we need to do is we need to not fixate on forms. What we need to do is fixate on what the end result is going to be. So how do we best look after our economy, and how do we best look after the safety and security of our citizens?
OK. Well, just moving on to what the rest of this week's going to bring. We are, of course, in parliamentary recess, so not as busy as it is, and Brexit chat will no doubt continue to dominate. We know that the Prime Minister has already taken a bit of a break. She's been away in northern Italy. She is back for a few days for the Passchendaele commemorations in Belgium before she goes away again for another two-week walking break in the Swiss Alps. Sam, it does seem that this is quite a long break for the Prime Minister at a time when we have this situation where some people have suggested that she's lacking authority, that her cabinet are divided on such significant issues. Do you think she's going away for too long?
Theresa May does seem to like long holidays. She had a long holiday last year. She's having a long holiday this week for 3 weeks this year. And Damian Green is going to be in charge, notionally in charge of the country next week. Philip Hammond returning the week after to do a second stint. I think what's interesting is the contrast between when she's here and when she's not. I think you are getting a greater freedom of some people to speak out when she's not. She is not a politician who changes gear easily. She's not a politician who reaches across and does consensus easily. She's not a politician who's that in command of her cabinet due to the weakness of the election result. So I think that it is interesting hearing a thousand flowers bloom when the Prime Minister is not there. But it's not clear to me that when she is there, she's got the political clout to bang Boris Johnson and Philip Hammond's head together and say, come on, guys, get an answer.
Nadim, one of your colleagues, David Jones, a Conservative backbencher, has written today a piece in the Mail on Sunday suggesting that because Theresa May's away, you have other cabinet colleagues on manoeuvres in her absence. How widely is that view shared?
I don't think they are on manoeuvres. Actually, if you look at the period that the Prime Minister has been away, there's been some very important announcements on freehold rights that Sajid Javid delivered, i.e. some of these new developments that are taking place where people should own their freehold are being taken advantage of. There'll be some more, I suspect, in the coming days as well in other areas, health and elsewhere. So I think there's a very strong programme, and I think it demonstrates real confidence in her cabinet that she's able to go away and feel that both domestically but also on the European negotiations, which clearly are the sort of the big priority, that she's able to trust her team to deliver. As I go back and say to you, there's always going to be in sort of August this sort of silly season stories about challenges to Prime Minister. We used to get it with David Cameron when he was Prime Minister in the sort of holiday season, as to whether there are manoeuvrings from other parts of the party to try and, on whatever issue, try and influence the...
Too much warm Prosecco.
Well, exactly, too much warm Prosecco, David Lidington quite rightly said. So I think, actually, the positive from the parliamentary party, from the backbenchers, is there's a whole sort of list of announcements that have come through. That demonstrates that actually, the ministers are getting on with the job.
Government functions perfectly when Theresa May isn't there.
Well, one thing that is happening later on this week, we're expecting a High Court ruling over whether Tony Blair and the former Foreign Secretary Jack Straw and the former Attorney General Lord Goldsmith can be prosecuted under UK law over the Iraq war. Emily, interested in your thoughts on this, because Jeremy Corbyn has said in the past that he's convinced the war was illegal and anyone who committed a war crime should be charged. So what do you make of this?
I think the difficulty with this particular aspect of international law is that there are as many different views of this as there are international lawyers. So I think that it is difficult to come down solidly one way or the other. For me, the important lessons from Iraq are about who is it that's in the room when we make decisions? On what basis do we make those decisions? And making sure that when we do become involved in armed conflict in another country, that we have a clear idea of what it is that we want to achieve. And I think those lessons are the ones that we should take away from the Iraq war. And I don't think that we have really learned those lessons yet. I think that if you look at what has happened in Libya, a number of other incidents, I think we still haven't got this clear in our heads. I think that some of the talk in relation to Syria has also been, not been clear thinking. So for me, I think that that would be, if we want to move on as a country and learn from this, that is the way we ought to be approaching it and not focusing on particular individuals.
Well, we'll get that High Court ruling this week. And Sam, Nadim did mention that there have been some policy announcements over the past week or so from the government beyond Brexit. And tomorrow we're expecting something on mental health, on extra investment in recruitment and retention. How important has that been to the government and how important is that subject area likely to be?
Well, it's one of those perennial holiday subjects that comes up because it provides easy announcements for the government. They're saying tomorrow that they're going to create thousands of new roles and expanding the mental health workforce. What I would say is that There has been a sense of stability while Theresa May has been out of the country with these sort of daily announcements, and they have rolled them out pretty well. The interesting thing is the extent to which there's a contrast with Theresa May's behaviour and control of the cabinet before the election, where, as it were, she didn't let cabinet ministers do this kind of thing, make announcements, explain what was going on in their departments, partly because she wanted to keep all the news for herself and partly because she made decisions personally at such a slow rate that nothing ever got decided. So just the mere fact of there being almost daily updates on what's going on in government is just a noticeable change and a consequence of the election result, which didn't go in her favour.
OK. Well, now a subject which was prominent in that election campaign and that has been causing some difficulties for Labour this week, university tuition fees. The party's been accused of doing a U-turn after Jeremy Corbyn said Labour would deal with existing student debt, which some said was a suggestion the party would wipe it all out. Well, they've now said that would cost too much, but Labour is committed to abolishing tuition fees in the future if it wins power. And with graduates now expected to leave university owing on average £50,000, a senior cabinet minister has called for a national debate. The Labour peer, Andrew Adonis, was responsible for introducing fees as a minister under Tony Blair. And he told our reporter John Beasley, it's time for a rethink.
What the Cameron Clegg coalition did in 2010 was overnight to treble fees and change from a system of co-payment to a system of, for most courses, sole payment by the students. And what the government, I think, thought would be regarded as an incremental change came to be regarded as a fundamental change, deeply unfair, very unpopular and unsustainable.
But a degree is a real benefit in the jobs market. So why should not graduates make a contribution, and if they can afford it, a very large contribution towards their education?
Graduates make a huge contribution to the cost of education through the tax system. The higher rate of tax, the 40p rate, is almost entirely paid by graduates. The reason why we introduced tuition fees in 2004 is that at the time, Tony Blair didn't want to raise the top rate of tax. He got elected on a commitment that income tax rates would not increase, and he thought it would be a major breach of faith to change the tax rates. And that's why, in order to fund universities properly, we had to move instead to a system of upfront fees paid by students with loans given to them to cover the cost, which they then repaid through the tax system after graduation. Now, the problem now is that exactly the same mentality that led Tony Blair not to raise the top rate of tax is precisely what students and young graduates are now accusing the current government of, because the trebling of fees overnight they saw as a massive breach of faith, and an even bigger breach of faith was the move to a 6.1% real rate of interest, which means that many graduates will stand to repay £100,000 once the capital that they've borrowed plus the rolled up interest are all accounted for, and that simply isn't sustainable.
Well, that begs the question, of course, what are the alternatives? Because, of course, universities need to be well funded, and students benefit from a securely funded university.
There are a number of different ways one could raise the money. One could cut the fee level significantly back down to the original £3,000 and reintroduce some element of state funding. One could end the absurdity of counting international students in the immigration numbers, which is a big disincentive for universities to recruit international students who are worth £4 billion a year in fees this year and could be a lot more if we gave them encouragement. We could increase the top rate of tax as a new deal with universities, which enabled us to scrap fees and loans. There are lots of different alternatives. What I think we now need is a national debate on how we move forward, accepting that it's not right to lumber young graduates buying houses, starting families with £100,000 worth of debt, particularly for those who are on courses which give them a less great benefit in the jobs market, but are still expected to pay back a huge amount during their lifetime of earnings.
And indeed, Damien Green, one of Theresa May's most senior cabinet ministers, has said there could be a national debate. Maybe there should be one. The thing is, though, that the whole question has become highly politicised recently. Jeremy Corbyn saying that fees should be abolished. Can you really see any possibility for cross-party consensus here?
There was cross-party consensus around the 2004 scheme of fees at £3,000 with no real rate of interest. The fairness of the scheme was easy to demonstrate. And there was cross-party consensus in the 2005 election and the 2010 election. What broke the consensus was the Cameron-Clegg coalition government's unilateral decision to treble the fees from £3,000 to £9,000. And the Labour Party then started to move as a party against tuition fees. I simply don't believe the Conservative Party can go into the next election committed to maintaining a system of fees, which by then will be £10,000 a year with 6.1% interest, and the Labour Party pledged to abolish them. I just don't think that that's going to happen.
And of course, Jeremy Corbyn said that he would abolish tuition fees. He also said that he would deal with historic student debt. Do you think that those people who thought perhaps that he would get rid of their historic debt, were they misled by him?
Well, I'm not an expert on the utterances of Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, he said he told the enemy that he would deal with student debt.
Yeah, well, I haven't myself gone through the fine print of what he said when and so on. What do I think is practical, though? I simply don't think it's practical to write off historic student debt, but I do think that any future government, whether it's Labour or Tory, is going to cut the level of fees dramatically and quite possibly abolish the fees outright.
Emily, just dealing first with that point, did Jeremy Corbyn mislead young voters with that suggestion that he'll deal with historic student debt?
Well, you know, I'm an old-fashioned girl and I, you know, went on the manifesto and was in the manifesto meetings and just didn't look at the enemy to see what amendments there might be to our policy there. Of course he didn't. This is nonsense. This is old-fashioned Tory kick it about. You know, let's make up something that we can have a go at the Labour Party about.
Not
let's
just the
get
Tories,
the media.
Too.
And then let's get some of the newspapers behind it, and let's see if we can make a big thing of it, and then Labour has to come out and deny it, and then we've got a story. No. Our policy is what was in the manifesto, which is pretty dramatic, which was that we were going to get rid of student fees and we were going to introduce loans. We were going to introduce maintenance grants for the poorest, and we had it costed. And unlike the Tories, who only had the only numbers they had were the page numbers in their manifestos, we had a detailed manifesto.
I can see both Nadim and Matt raising their eyebrows at me in desperation to interject here. Matt, go for it.
Well, actually, to your surprise, perhaps, I'm going to support what you're saying. I did read the NME and I've read all of the statement that Jeremy said about tuition fees, and the top half is very clear and in line with the manifesto. And then he gets into the iniquity of the historical debt and says, why should people who went through this suffer either before this decision or after this decision? Yeah. And he says, I'll deal with it. Now, what does that mean, I'll deal with it? And I think, to be fair, to cut the guy some slack, I'll deal with it could well mean I'm going to do my best and I'm going to take it.
He says he'd take a look at it.
And I think you're absolutely right that it has been seized upon. It doesn't seem like a gotcha moment to me. But the topic of tuition fees, I think, is the topic of coming up. It's going to be of such significance. And we see it with Bernie Sanders in the States. We're seeing it with Jeremy Corbyn here. We're seeing the governor of New York, Cuomo, who's going to stand against Trump in 2020, has just made tuition fees free in New York State. I think tuition fees, tied in with a younger demographic, a newly politicised demographic, are going to be a massively important topic in this
And Nadim, that's the point, isn't it? I mean, that's the point that Lord Adonis was making. Can the Tories realistically go into another election saying that they're going to keep £9,000 worth of tuition fees?
Well, just on Emily's point first, two of her shadow cabinet
You were dying to get
both are on a video actually saying that we will get rid of tuition fees and the debt. That's what Jeremy Corbyn will do. So it's not made up.
So moving on from the politics briefly to the substance of this, because this is a huge issue.
So the priority for any government, and the OECD has said actually the UK is one of the few countries where we've got a sustainable system for funding universities. The priority has got to be one, obviously access to those families who could never dream of going to university needs to be prioritised. That's number one. Two, that our universities are funded so they can do great research and be, you know, world class. And three, a way for paying for it that is fair to, you know, everyone who pays taxes. A lot of people who don't go to university pay those taxes. That's the thing. So when you look at it being funded in a different way, Scotland, for example, where they've abolished tuition fees, actually access to those families, those students from the lower income background has dropped, whereas access has gone up by 43% in England.
But isn't the problem that the system is simply unsustainable? Because you've just got this growing mountain of debt. The IFS says, you know, three quarters of students aren't going to be paying this back.
It's 50%. We looked at it when I was on the Business Select Committee. We looked at this. So 50% of debt doesn't get paid because you only start paying back when you earn 21,000.
Although the Institute of Fiscal Studies does put that at three quarters.
Right. Even if it's at three quarters, that's not a bad thing. Actually, that's an incentive in the system that allows people who are graduates who never earn enough to not pay it back. That is part of the actual design of the system, which is why the OECD has said it's a sustainable system.
But it wasn't part of the original
system.
Design that they had to pay it back at such ridiculously high interest rates, for example. But flog off the student debt into the private sector, and then they hike up the interest rates. And it's just, clearly it's not fair and it's not sustainable. And why should people, I got my education free, and I look at other generations and I think it's not fair. They've got huge problems buying themselves a house or getting anywhere to live where they can even set up a family. On top of that, they're also up their eyeballs.
Time is tight. Damien Green's call for a national debate on this. Yes. I'm sure we could debate this endlessly, and we will do down the line.
Well, I can tell you where we're going to pay for it. As you say, it was in our manifesto. So the abolition annually costs £9.5 billion, £11.2 including maintenance grants. Over 4 years, that will be £38
billion. And the debt.
And we will pay for that by increasing income tax for the top 5% and reverse corporation tax changes.
Leaving it there for 1 minute. Nadim, I am just interested to know, very briefly, in a word, if you can, do you think the Tories will go into the next election without moving on this?
I think we've created a system that is sustainable, that is actually the right system. Let's not talk it down. Let's look at the detail. I'll tell you where I agree with Andrew Donis is, why would a vice chancellor for, I think it was Bath University, get £500,000 a year?
Strictly
why are we not creating a more vigorous market? Why is everyone going to the top?
This is extraordinary. This is an extraordinary point. And Andrew Adonis writes in the New European a piece next week, and my jaw fell when I read the last part about the Vice Chancellor of Bath, £551,000. But beneath him, 66 people on more than 100 grand. I mean, it is strictly come dancing money, that. Ridiculous.
Okay, we have to leave it there. Now, can politicians do God in contemporary Britain when a growing proportion of the population say they have no religion? It certainly proved difficult for Tim Farron, the former Lib Dem leader, who says he was treated with suspicion because he's a committed Christian. Attitudes to gay sex, abortion, money, the role of women can all be shaped by faith. But what if there's a conflict between an MP's personal beliefs and their party's position on such issues? Faisal Farooq has been asking whether religion and politics can be reconciled.
Sunday morning hymns at St Barnabas Church in Walthamstow, where I'd gone to speak to a Christian active in local politics. But he wasn't in the congregation listening to the service, he was leading it.
I'm always reminded of the words of the great Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who said, "I don't know which Bible people are reading when they tell me that religion and politics don't mix."
So my name is Canon Stephen Saxby. I'm a priest here in Walthamstow. And on top of that, I'm the treasurer of Christians on the Left, an active member of the Labour Party, and aspiring to be a political candidate at some point, I hope, for Parliament. I came to faith and Christianity at the same time. As I sort of came to Christianity as a teenager, started reading the Bible. I was also reading about the early founders of the Labour Party, and many of whom were inspired by their faith, and that inspired me also to get engaged in politics. So for me, it's always been a twin track, church and politics, and my work in the church has always been thinking about how the church interacts with wider society and connects with supporting the most vulnerable people in our communities.
But not every Christian in the UK can talk so freely about their faith and their politics, according to DUP MP Ian Paisley Jr.
Northern Ireland has strong religious views, that the people here are unashamed of their religious views. I feel when I go to England, people whisper the fact that they might be Christian because they live in a modern post-Christian society and therefore they shouldn't really talk about these things. I think it's becoming more and more impossible to have the debate because sensible things, you're not allowed to say them anymore because you might offend someone. In fact, a person might get up very deliberately to be offended by a person's Christian view, because that way they advance their view over them.
Labour's Angela Eagle MP is a patron of Humanists UK. She thinks that's down to how people choose to interpret their faith.
I think that there are many people of faith that I've come across in my 25 years as an MP that wouldn't take the view that somehow it was incompatible to be involved with politics and have faith-based views. It's only a particular sort of strain of conservative evangelicalism that takes that very almost fundamentalist approach. And I think progressive people of faith, I find, are pretty open-minded. We have a lot in common.
From the very first day of my leadership 2 years ago, I have faced questions about my Christian faith. To be a political leader, especially of a progressive liberal party in 2017, and to live as a committed Christian, to hold faithfully to the Bible's teaching has felt impossible for me.
Tim Farron, resigning as Liberal Democrat leader a few weeks ago. He said he was treated with suspicion because of his faith. So does that mean there isn't a place in politics for people with certain religious views? Conservative MP Nigel Evans is both Christian and gay. He says that depends on your voters.
I think it probably depends when you talk about traditionalist views, that when you go for selections in the first place, that if you are asked questions and that all of a sudden you, let's say, come out with some views that perhaps are not mainstream to the constituency that you're applying for, then you're probably not going to get selected. So most people might well have, say, strong religious views, but you are going to balance that by the fact that you're representing 75,000 people who may have somewhat different views to yourself. And so you've got to, there is definitely a balancing act there as far as representation in the House of Commons is concerned.
Whilst some are criticised for their religious beliefs being out of step with their politics, others have been accused of having politics out of step with their faith. When he was an MP, London Mayor Sadiq Khan received death threats from Muslim extremists because he voted for gay marriage. But Labour MP Tulip Sadiq says it's a mistake to make assumptions about her politics based on her religious background.
I grew up in a Muslim household, and to be honest, I wouldn't say that I am religious as such. I would say I'm more cultural. So I think it's very hard now to generalise or simplify whether a certain person who is Muslim will vote in a certain way in terms of policy. One of the things I will probably say to you is that when I've been very pro-choice, or when I voted in favour of assisted dying, there have been sometimes reactions of people saying to me, I'm glad you voted for that, despite your religion. And I kind of laughed to myself because I think it had nothing to do with my religion. When I was in that voting lobby, casting my vote, I did not think for one second about my religion. I thought about what my political values were and my beliefs were, and they were shaped more by my family and my experiences. So I would say the biggest factor in determining how I voted has been experience, talking to people, reading a lot, and what I really believe in.
Whether faith has a role in helping individual politicians make good decisions is open to debate, but Nick Spencer of Christian think tank Theos says it might at the very least make them better people.
Christianity says God is God and you aren't. And for someone who is very successful, very talented, perhaps very rich, very charismatic, who has risen to the top of the political tree, is very fond of power, to retain a belief which says you are fallible, you are under judgment, you will get things wrong, and you need to apologise for it, or to confess, to use a religious word, I think that's very useful indeed.
Although some parliamentarians have found public scrutiny of their religious views an ordeal, others have found that in private, their faith has helped them through their darkest days in the job. Nigel Evans again.
I think that at times when there are crises going on, and clearly there a lot of members of parliament are under pressure and stress, and a lot of MPs then go through personal problems, as I have done, whilst they're members of parliament, or indeed anxieties as to what they should do. To go and pick up a Bible, to sit down and close your eyes, and to think and pray, have that silence, that meditation, that very closeness to God is something that I find gives me a strength that I really never really properly appreciated. Oh my goodness me, did I need it.
Nigel Evans ending that report from Faisal Farouk. And Matt, you've actually written in defence of Tim Farron, if you like, saying that he was overly criticised for his convictions.
It wasn't so much in defence of Tim Farron or what he believes in, but it was in a sense of exasperation that in this age of everybody claiming to be a conviction politician but acting as though, you know, the convictions that they truly hold are the least things they're worried about, here was the guy whose anguish was visible on his face and as he was wrestling with various things. And I thought, There's a certain transparency there and honesty that I admired in him. And the fact that he acted in contradiction to those convictions for what he saw as the greater good, I thought was entirely commendable. And it's the politicians who don't look pained and anguished that I'm worried about, not the ones that do.
But Nadim, is there a problem, do you think, when your personal beliefs don't reconcile with your party's position and you are going to be that prominent a figure?
Well, clearly, Tim found it a problem in his own party. I mean, I have to say, you know, personal faith I think is a wonderful thing, but you know, hailing from the Middle East, I think probably the greatest thing Europe ever did was separate church and state. And I just wish that one day the Middle East would see that happen across the board. It's not there yet, and you know, you've got some terrible crimes being committed in the name of religion, whichever side of the divide you come from. And it really is a terrible thing. So I guess my judgment's coloured by my family's experience of a region which still is trying to grapple with the separation between church and state.
And isn't that the point, Emily? You can never really separate something so personal as your faith from your politics.
I think that's probably right. And I think in the end, you know, people want to have politicians who say what they mean and mean what they say. And I don't think that it's contradictory from our main religions. I don't think our politics contradicts that, actually. And I think that if you do find things within your faith that mean that you just don't believe what your party is doing, then you don't become the party's leader.
OK. Just now, we've got the newspapers in for tomorrow. Sam, take us through them if you can, because the story on the front page of the Times happens to be yours, which is this suggestion, we return back to the Brexit discussion, and this suggestion that Philip Hammond has somewhat softened his position, saying that Britain's not going to deregulate to undercut the EU if it doesn't get the deal it wants.
6 months ago, Philip Hammond went to Germany with a threat, and the threat was that if the European Union does not give Britain a strong trade deal, then we would change our economic model, slash taxes, slash regulation, and compete a bit like Singapore, not his words, but what everybody interpreted, a bit like Singapore. Now, we've got hold of the transcript of an interview that he did with Le Monde last Thursday, where he says, well, he's massively softened his tone. He says that is now neither, he seems almost surprised at the suggestion that we would be like Singapore on the English Channel. That is neither our plan nor our vision for the future. And then he says some things that are going to potentially upset a few people. The amount of tax we in Britain raise as a percentage of our GDP, it puts us right in the middle of the pack. We don't want that to change, even after we've left the EU. I would expect us to remain a country with the social, economic and cultural model that is recognisably European.
Nadine, briefly, if you would, what do you make of that?
That's exactly what the Prime Minister said many times from the dispatch box. And of course, the European Withdrawal Bill, the Great Repeal Bill, or what I refer to as sort of, the continuity bill effectively enshrines European regulations and laws into our own. And, again, Sam has to write column inches.
And Nadim has nice stories.
And I'm just saying to you, that's always been Theresa May's position.
But the columns are quite filled still with these Brexit divisions in the cabinet, The Guardian, The Telegraph, carrying similar stories on the front page tomorrow.
I just want to understand what you're really saying here. Are you saying that the Tories never said that that an option for Britain was that we would become a low tax, low red tape, haven for business, and that we would fundamentally change the British economic model? Because I kind of heard the Prime Minister say that. I really did. And I heard a number of Tories quite enthusiastically saying that. And now we've got the Chancellor saying something exactly
the
opposite.
When did you hear the Prime Minister saying that, Emily? Give me one quote from the Prime Minister saying that.
You know that big speech where she's supposed to set out everything? Mm. That was one of the options that she said. Or in that speech, in the Lancaster House speech. Right?
So the Chancellor said it in January. The Chancellor said the opposite this weekend.
Well, as ever, in the best form of political discussions, we shall leave it on a point of disagreement. And Matt, I'm sorry you didn't get the final word in, but no doubt these subjects, Brexit is not going anywhere anytime soon, and we will have plenty of time to return to this and other subjects over the course of the summer as the silly season, Nadim, continues in full force. But sadly, we are out of time. So thank you so much to all of my guests, Sam Coates, Emily Thornbury, Nadim Sahawi and Matt Kelly. The Westminster Hour will be back at the same time next week. Thank you so much for listening to us tonight. From all of us here, good night.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.